Good morning, everyone. We're going to continue our discussion about how to live intuitively. So let's begin with a prayer. Heavenly Father, Divine Mother, Friend, Beloved God, Jesus Christ, Babaji Krishna, Lahiri Mahashaya, Swami Sri Yukteswar, Beloved Master, Paramhansa Yogananda, Saints of all religion, dearest friend Swami Kriyananda, humbly we bow at thy feet. Bless us with an awareness of your presence, that we may be inwardly guided by the light of your wisdom. Rescue us from the random inclinations of our samskaras, our past life tendencies, and show us how to be dynamically present in this moment, living in the now for all eternity. Om, peace. Amen. Sometimes we have all different topics, all different names for different classes, but it's kind of a joke that eventually you get back to just saying the same things. Love God, be in tune, meditate, serve. Savitri, Nayaswami Savitri, who many of you know because she's a wonderful teacher who lives at Ananda Village and an author, and I'll just plug one of her books just while I'm doing it. She wrote a trilogy of novels, a fictional trilogy of the stories of people in higher ages, and the last one was, I think, To the Doors of Death and Beyond. The word death is in it. It's a wonderful. They're all good books. The last one especially is really a marvelous book. Since I just did my talk about death and dying, I know I mentioned her book. I just want to say it again. Nayaswami Savitri at Ananda Village. You can order it directly from her. She took Master's teachings on death and dying and wove them into a story. It's really exquisitely done. And Nalini Graber's book, Transitions with Grace. These are really fine books worth reading. But what I really wanted to say, and I really was just going to talk about Savitri, she was raised in Memphis, lived in Texas, and even after all her years in California, she still has a touch of that way of speaking, which charms us all. Swami Uma, who was born in Manchester, England, and came to America at the age of 18, lived at Ananda from her early 20s. She said to Swami once, "Why was I born in England?" And Swami said, "Oh, so you could have that accent and we could spend the rest of your life teasing you about it." I sort of feel like Savitri brought that little southern accent to us so that we could all just enjoy it. The end of all of this is just to say that she would joke, no matter what you call the class, she said the subject is always alligators, crocodiles, and big lizards. No matter what you name them, you come back to the same central truth, because that's what it is. Now, this is the context. When I started this series, which is just a few days old now, the subject title that we often use is How to Know and Trust Your Inner Guidance. But that seemed a little long and a little clunky for what we were doing, so we brought it down to living intuitively, which is actually, it's a big lizard instead of a crocodile. But it was interesting. I was thinking of it this morning because I started out announcing I have these 22 points from this iconic class that Swami Kriyananda gave and so on. But I'm finding that I can't go there. It's just, for one thing, I'm never very good at repeating, and I'm never very good at following a structure. Any place where I have to follow a structure is very difficult for me. I really like to just do what I want to do. But I also was realizing that how to know and trust your inner guidance is really different in the feeling of it from living intuitively. Living intuitively is more just how we approach life and who we are. The idea of guidance, it did, that's why it came down to 22 points, just like these are the things that you think of, this is true guidance. It's not that they're unrelated, but the facets of the diamond. Savitri said it humorously, but nonetheless, it's true. Facets of the diamond are different, and you look at it from different angles and you just see it differently. Living intuitively is a feeling for what our lives are about and who we are. And today what I wanted to talk about was our place in the universe. I've been playing with different titles. Every morning we sit down and what are you going to talk about and what should we call it? Which for those of you who are very astute may notice that before we start it has one title and by the time we finish it has another because Divine Mother had her own plans, whatever we were going to do. So I've been trying to get to humility as self-honesty, which is a wonderful topic, and I may touch some on it today. But when I start thinking about living intuitively, what I'm really thinking about is what is my place in the universe? Where do I fit? And certain exchanges that I've been having with people lately on relatively unrelated subjects, again, make it vivid to me. It's the balance between ego and humility is one of the most, it's the critical issue, likes and dislikes, and balancing ego and humility in terms of being able to discern between what inner voice is speaking to us in wisdom and what is just telling us what we want to hear. Because the desire to hear what we want to hear, whether we're listening to someone else, whether we're listening to a spiritual teacher, whether we're listening to the voice of God within us, the desire to hear what we want to hear is so intense. In my book, Swami Kriyananda, As We Have Known Him, I tell this story about this person who had made up their mind to follow a certain course of action. Swamiji knew that course of action would not bring the person the fulfillment they had hoped, but he also knew that that person was quite fixed on that point of view. In fact, what happened exactly was I knew the person was coming to talk to Swamiji about a very specific subject, and I called Swami and said, I think you need to know in advance that so-and-so is coming and they're going to present this possibility to you. He was very grateful because it gave him time to contemplate, and it allowed him in the course of the conversation to know what the parameters were. I have to say, sometimes I've told Swamiji things that people might not have expected me to tell him. I remember having a conversation with Swami saying, "Sir, sometimes people will tell me something." This is when I lived at the village and I would see Swami every day. "Sometimes people will tell me something and they'll say, 'Don't tell Swamiji.'" I said, "But after they tell me, I know that you need to know, and their desire for you not to know is a completely misguided misunderstanding of the benefit that you can prevent to the situation. So I have an inclination just to tell you." And Swami said, "Of course," he said, "I always told Master." I mean, I can say that out loud now because Swami's not here anymore, so no one is going to be afraid to say something to me. I kept that thought pretty much to myself as long as Swami was alive. But Swami's input is always helpful, even if people don't know that it's going to be. So I called Swami to warn him on this one, or to give him an advance notice is actually the right word. So the conversation went pretty much as Swamiji anticipated and I anticipated, which is, the person was absolutely set on that course of action, and Swami wanted to spare them the karma, but there was no way to spare them the karma. So at the end, the person said, "Well, you will bless me, won't you?" And Swami said, "I always bless you. You always have my blessings." So the person left the meeting with Swami saying, "Oh, Swami blesses what I'm about to do." And Swami did not bless what they were about to do. He blessed them. But we hear what we want to hear. I was in another meeting, this was like in the 1972. This man, who had many gifts, but business was not one of them, but in the weird way that our minds work, the man felt that being a businessman was the one thing he really needed to learn. Swami said, as explicitly as you can say it, I was in the room, "Spiritually speaking, it's not necessary for you to become good at business. You can advance spiritually without ever being good at business. It's not something you need to learn." The man wanted to start this business. Swami was suggesting that he not. He walked out saying, "Swami approves of my starting the business." And then, like, it never happened. I was there. And Swami, you know, I told Swami later, Swami just shrugged, and he was totally supportive. And the business was a disaster, just exactly what Swami knew. But the desire to hear what we want to hear, I mean, these are times when you would think you would be extremely attentive. But it's just like, it's like, this is how I think about it. We have these vrittis, and these vrittis are whirlpools of energy. A whirlpool of energy has an attracting power. I think of my consciousness sometimes like a ping pong ball, and it's trying to negotiate. Maybe it's a pinball machine, if such a thing still exists, where you have to try to get some little ball past all these traps, and all these traps are going to eat it and take it someplace you don't want it to go. Sometimes I feel with my consciousness, I have a clear intention. I know exactly what my intention is, but the ping pong ball of my consciousness, as it heads for that intention, there's all these vrittis, all these past inclinations, and on my way to go in a straight line, I accidentally get sucked into these vrittis, and I think I'm still going in a straight line, except I've taken a 35 degree turn and I'm heading off in this direction, and I'll keep going with great force, and only sort of a long time later, when I kind of orient myself, how did I ever get here? Because it happens all the time without us even actually being aware of it. So in order to live intuitively, we have to actually find our place in the universe and be comfortable in it. And there's two ways that we, well, there's a million ways in which we deflect ourselves, but there's two directions that we get confused in. And they're both based on insecurity, because everything's based on insecurity. We're always terribly insecure. No matter how confidently we appear, we're endlessly insecure until we're God realized. Because we always know that we're just so vulnerable in this world. I mean, just even your little body is just so vulnerable. The smallest things can just derail you so easily, and big things can derail you completely. And of course, death is always lurking, and we never know when it's going to come, or economic collapse, or betrayal, or who knows what. And endless joy is also waiting there for us if we just understand what to let go of and what to embrace. But what I was let me get this thought here. There's two ways that our mind aberrates. And one is that we think that we're just small and unworthy and incapable, and I couldn't do it. No, definitely not me. No, 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 not me. Anyone but me. And the other side of it is, I'm so special in the eyes of God. You know, He knows He really has something good in me. And I'm just waiting for the call when I will become whatever gigantic thing I actually really know I am. Like this. And so we become vulnerable to false guidance from both of those sides. We become vulnerable to false guidance when we think we're really special, because we're vulnerable to flattery. If somebody tells us we really have this destiny, it just fits right into our self-concept, especially if it's a destiny that's not going to require a lot of work to achieve. You know, like you're secretly self-realized, or you're actually really a great teacher and that you came here to teach. To be a teacher and to be a healer are the two that tend to attract people's attention. Now, you may be a teacher and you may be a healer, but it's dangerous when your guidance tells you as a conclusion that that's who you are. Because it derails us. Well, it derails us in countless ways, but one of the ways it derails us is that we lose track of all the hard work that's required to get from who I am now to what I'm going to be. There was a very sad situation that happened at Ananda, in which Swamiji was trying to help a person understand that they had a serious potential to do really good work for Master. And he wanted them to take that responsibility seriously. But unfortunately, instead of taking the responsibility seriously and understanding what was going to be required to realize it, the person took their potential as a present reality. And then from that point on, just expected to be treated as if that was their present reality. Whereas, as Swami said later, maybe 25 years in the future was a potential if the person did all the hard work that was required between here and there. It was a gamble Swami took in presenting that person's potential to them, a calculated risk that the person did not pass the test. Most of the time, saints and masters do not flatter us. Now, in Swami's own case, interestingly enough, Master said to him repeatedly, "You have a great work to do." Now, instead of that making Swamiji feel like he was a great soul who just was sitting there waiting to be recognized, for Swamiji, and Master knew this, it became this extraordinary sense of responsibility and this enormous need to work constantly, unrelentingly, in order to fulfill the potential that Master had given him, that Master had commissioned him, the responsibility that Master had laid upon him. Swamiji dedicated his life to fulfilling it. And he never saw it as a reason for sitting back on his laurels. It was the challenge that was required in order for him to come forward. Now, the other way that we don't listen to guidance is that we don't, and it's sort of like both sides are ego. You know, to think that I'm extra special and to think that I'm extra bad are both just a misunderstanding. And this is why true humility is self-honesty. It's just seeing things as they are. You know, if we put ourselves down too much, well, Swami said, if you're always piling dirt on your own head, he said, you become focused entirely on dirt and your own head, neither of which is really very helpful for spiritual accomplishment, for spiritual growth. Humility is to recognize that I have limitations, but then to exaggerate and say, oh, no, not me. No, no, of course not me. Because the result of that is everyone rallies around and says, yes, you. So it sort of ends up taking us back to the other side where everybody has to flatter us to sort of just to keep us upright. There was a friend of mine, a very talented, very fine lady, just who could just do everything she set her mind to. She did superbly. She had already accomplished a great deal in her life and was just an invaluable beneficiary to Master's work, really wonderfully so. But she absolutely insisted on always talking about herself as worthless, which put all of us in endless conversations, having to tell her how wonderful she was. And it was just exhausting, absolutely exhausting. And one day we were sort of running that cycle. And I took a chance, but I finally said, look, Swami Kriyananda thinks you're wonderful. And then I named about five or six other, you know, really impressive sadhakas, fellow gurubhais, who were leaders of Ananda, who also think she's wonderful. I said, you're the only one who thinks you're not. I said, what are the chances that all those people are wrong and you're the only one who has it correct? And it was just, she sat there for a moment and then she started to laugh. Thank you, God. She started to laugh. And she really realized in the name of being nothing, she was actually asserting her ego with astonishing arrogance because she just wouldn't listen to anybody. The only voice she would listen to was the voice inside of her that told her she was terrible. And yeah, of course she had her faults. She wasn't an avatar. She isn't an avatar. But she's a very fine person with a lot of talents. And I think that began to make her shift. I recall when I was trying to write the first book I wrote, which is Swami Kriyananda's I Have Known Him, I spent 3 years not writing it. You know, having announced to the world that I was going to write it, having dropped in great many of my responsibilities so that I could write it, I spent 3 years not writing it. It was very tough karma for me. Now it was, you know, like close to 20 years ago, so it doesn't sting like it stung at the time, but it was an awful experience. I had some really bad karma to pay off. I had a very critical mind. And you can't be creative and critical simultaneously. Good critics are rarely creative people on their own. And so every time I would create, I would criticize, and then I would delete. And I literally, after 3 years, I did not have one usable paragraph. And that is not an exaggeration. It was quite something. And one of the things that finally got me through and actually helped turn the tide, many things helped turn the tide. I changed the focus of the book. I expiated the karma. I suffered as much as I needed to suffer. But I realized that I was the only one who thought I couldn't write it. That everybody, including Swami, thought I could. And I mean, that was years before I spoke to my friend. But one of the reasons I did is because I came to that. I thought, wow, what are the chances? What are the chances that I'm right and Swami's wrong? It's never happened before. It's not likely to happen now. The only reason I was so confused is it was because it was about me. Well, after all, we're talking about me. You know, we just get completely distorted. There's a Steve Martin movie that I saw, and I think the movie was a little too raunchy for me to actually recommend it. But I have to frankly admit that I also enjoyed it. But Steve Martin, who's a very good comedian, he was an aspiring movie producer or a movie director or something like that. It was Hollywood spoofing itself. And he was just, you know, a two-bit nothing in the context. But he had this team, and he was trying to lead his team, and they were all characters. And he was giving a pep talk to his team, and he was talking about how we will do this, and we will do that, and the universe will respond, and we will get all these accolades. And then in his comedic way, without breaking the flow, without changing his tone of voice, he said, "And when I say we, I mean me." Just like that. Every time I think about that sometimes, and when I say we, I mean me. And he was just mocking that. But as a devotee, what happens, you see, is we think that the universe, that the universe is an interrelated reality of cause and effect, in which Divine Mother is in charge, in which everything happens for the best, and the whole world is beautiful, and we're all manifestations of God, except for this one tiny little exception, which is me. And I'm either much better or much worse, just because it's me. Because I'm inside this body, I'm resting in this egoic medulla, and I'm viewing it out from the spiritual eye. But if I could rise above it, even just a little bit, I would see that I'm just one of many players. I'm neither the worst nor the best. I was in my desk at Ananda Publications back in the early 70s when the building was like three quarters finished, but we were using it because that's what we did in those days, and we were able to do it. We weren't as so tightly controlled by the county. And so, you know, there were a lot of creatures inside that building with us. One very significant day, unrelated to what I'm about to say, we took this poster down that had been on the wall for a long time and realized that a whole family of bats was living behind that. I'm not a person who has an instinctive relationship with nonverbal creatures. And bats are creepy. I mean, I know that people can say they're not, but they're creepy. And so all of a sudden, these bats were flying around in the office, which was a bit unnerving in itself. And finally, things settled down a bit, and I sat at my desk and I started writing, and a bat came and landed right on the paper that I was writing. Now, all of this is a little unclear to me, but it was reported to me by witnesses. First, I got up, I went over, I picked up an empty box, I set the box over the bat, and then I screamed. But I did all that first, and then I just screamed because it was a bat. And it was so creepy. Now, but creatures. So I'm at my desk, and there's this spider, and spiders come in even to the finest homes. Spiders will enter. It was just a little spider, but it had a lot of attitude. It was a real, like, spunky spider. I don't know who he's going to be next, but it's going to be somebody impressive. And I had a typewriter, that's what we had in those days, and he was running around my typewriter, and he was hopping. He would be on one key or another, on the space bar, on the platen, on the handle, and I was just watching him. He was very small. I call him he because he had sort of a masculine attitude toward life. Could have been a female, but the attitude was masculine. So it's masculine in the sense of, here I am and I am the king and I'm going to conquer. That's what he was going to do. And I kept thinking, you have no idea, you know, see this thumb, see how small you are, just like that. And all your ambitions are over, just like that. Then I suddenly had this picture, and it's sort of like I rose just a little above my body, and I was seeing myself from Divine Mother's perspective, and I saw myself walking over the hill from Ayodhya, where I lived, across the pond, the dam by the pond, just the route I would take every morning to get to Pubble. And all the while I was walking, I could see Divine Mother had her thumb over, and I have a lot of attitude too. You know, I had a lot of attitude, a lot of masculine attitude in a female body coming across. And I could just see Divine Mother just watching my little ambitions, you know, coming over like this. And she was just saying to me, just like that, if I wanted to end your life right now, your life would end just like that little spider. Now, I think that's what the good news. That whole story is not depressing to me. I let the spider have its life. I don't know if I even bothered to take it outside. I think I just let it do whatever it wanted to do, just like Divine Mother lets me. And my ambitions are not foolish. That spider was doing a very good job of being a spider. I mean, if you find yourself in a spider body, you should be a good spider. As Swami put it to me once, you don't get out of karma by doing it badly. That was a very interesting statement. You have to, whatever's assigned to you, you have to do it as well as you can do it. I mean, as Swami said to me once when I was trying to, I think I actually said this to him. Yeah, I think I did. I think I told him that the problem was that I was arrogant. And part of the reason is that I was arrogant was that I was rather smart. So maybe if I just made myself stupider, I wouldn't be so arrogant. He did not endorse that as a plan. No, that's not how it works. You don't get out of karma by doing it badly. You have to be the very best that you're capable of being. But you're just a spider on a typewriter. And Divine Mother could just snuff your life out in a moment. And the other side of it is, even if you become the best at whatever little pond you're swimming in, you know, even if it's a planetary best, what's a planet? There's billions of planets. And you shine in this hour, and in 1,000 years, who will ever remember you? I was very touched by the documentary I saw of Yo-Yo Ma, who's, of course, one of the greatest cellists ever and is still at the top of his profession. I think he was 20 when he was universally acknowledged as the best cellist that had ever appeared on the scene. And in this documentary, he seems to be a very thoughtful and a nice person. He just said, I was hardly grown up, and I'd already reached the pinnacle of what people would spend their lives doing. He said, so I had to find another way to find meaning in life. You know, it's just like, yeah, okay, so there you are, but and after that? You know, so what we really have to become, and I'll use the word here, and I guess I'm going to have more to say about it tomorrow, we have to become impersonal. Impersonal means to be impersonal about yourself, which is, just because it's me, it doesn't really make any difference. I'm not really different than you. My perspective on me is different, but in the universal scheme of things, we're just all in it together. And I do want to say more. I'll start more on the next time we talk, sort of about how to really live with that. But once we become comfortable with our place in the universe, it's much easier to know basically what God wants us to do from our place in the universe. So the next time we talk, that's what we'll talk about. God bless you.